Chapter 31. Philip shuddered visibly as he paused from his music. Then turning red, he said, with violent passion, "Get away, you lumbering idiot. Don't come bellowing at me. You're not fit to speak to anything but a cart horse." It was not the first time Philip had been made angry by him, but Tom had never before been assailed with verbal missiles that he understood so well. "I'm fit to speak to something better than you, you poor-spirited imp," said Tom, lighting up immediately at Philip's fire. "You know I won't hit you, because you're no better than a girl. But I'm an honest man's son, and your father's a rogue. Everybody says so." Tom flung out of the room, and slammed the door after him, made strangely heedless by his anger. For to slam doors within the hearing of Mrs. Stelling, who was probably not far off, was an offense only to be wiped out by 20 lines of Virgil. In fact, that lady did presently descend from her room, in double wonder at the noise, and the subsequent cessation of Philip's music. She found him sitting in a heap on T.E. Hassock, and crying bitterly. "What's the matter, Wackham? What was that noise about? Who slammed the door?" Philip looked up, and hastily dried his eyes. "It was Tulliver who came in, to ask me to go out with him." "And what are you in trouble about?" said Mrs. Stelling. Philip was not her favorite of the two pupils. He was less obliging than Tom, who was made useful in many ways. Still, his father paid more than Mr. Tulliver did, and she meant him to feel that she behaved exceedingly well to him. Philip, however, met her advances toward a good understanding very much as a caressed mollusk meets an invitation to show himself out of his shell. Mrs. Stelling was not a loving, tender-hearted woman. She was a woman whose skirt sat well, who adjusted her waist, and patted her curls with a preoccupied air when she inquired after your welfare. These things, doubtless, represent a great social power, but it is not the power of love, and no other power could win Philip from his personal reserve. He said, in answer to her question, "My toothache came on, and made me hysterical again." This had been the fact once, and Philip was glad of the recollection. It was like an inspiration, to enable him to excuse his crying. He had to accept eau de cologne, and to refuse creosote in consequence. But that was easy. Meanwhile Tom, who had for the first time sent a poisoned arrow into Philip's heart, had returned to the carriage house, where he found Mr. Poulter, with a fixed and earnest eye, wasting the perfections of his sword exercise on probably observant but inappreciative rats. But Mr. Poulter was a host in himself. That is to say, he admired himself more than a whole army of spectators could have admired him. He took no notice of Tom's return, being too entirely absorbed in the cut and thrust, the solemn 1, 2, 3, 4, and Tom, not without a slight feeling of alarm at Mr. Poulter's fixed eye and hungry-looking sword, which seemed impatient for something else to cut besides the air, admired the performance from as great a distance as possible. It was not until Mr. Poulter paused, and wiped the perspiration from his forehead, that Tom felt the full charm of the sword exercise, and wished it to be repeated. "Mr. Poulter," said Tom, when the sword was being finally sheathed, "I wish you'd lend me your sword a little while to keep." "No, no, young gentleman," said Mr. Poulter, shaking his head decidedly, "you might do yourself some mischief with it." "No, I'm sure I wouldn't. I'm sure I'd take care, and not hurt myself. I shouldn't take it out of the sheath much, but I could ground arms with it, and all that." "No, no, it won't do, I tell you, it won't do," said Mr. Poulter, preparing to depart. "What does Mr. Stelling say to me?" "Oh, I say, do, Mr. Poulter. I'd give you my 5-shilling piece, if you'd let me keep the sword a week." "Look here," said Tom, reaching out the attractively large round of silver. The young dog calculated the effect as well as if he had been a philosopher. "Well," said Mr. Poulter, with still deeper gravity, "you must keep it out of sight, you know." "Oh yes, I'll keep it under the bed," said Tom, eagerly, "or else at the bottom of my large box." And let me see now whether you can draw it out of the sheath without hurting yourself. That process having been gone through more than once, Mr. Poulter felt that he had acted with scrupulous conscientiousness, and said, "Well now, Master Tulliver, if I take the crown piece, it is to make sure as you will do no mischief with the sword." "Oh no, indeed, Mr. Poulter," said Tom, delightedly handing him the crown piece, and grasping the sword, which, he thought, might have been lighter with advantage. "But if Mr. Stelling catches you carrying it in?" said Mr. Poulter, pocketing the crown piece provisionally, while he raised this new doubt. "Oh, he always keeps in his upstairs study on Saturday afternoon," said Tom, who disliked anything sneaking, but was not disinclined to a little stratagem in a worthy cause. So he carried off the sword in triumph mixed with dread, that he might encounter Mr. or Mrs. Stelling to his bedroom, where, after some consideration, he hid it in the closet behind some hanging clothes. That night he fell asleep in the thought that he would astonish Maggie with it when she came, tie it round his waist with his red comforter, and make her believe that the sword was his own, and that he was going to be a soldier. There was nobody but Maggie who would be silly enough to believe him, or whom he dared allow to know he had a sword. And Maggie was really coming next week to see Tom, before she went to a boarding school with Lucy. If you think a lad of 13 would have been so childish, you must be an exceptionally wise man, who, although you are devoted to a civil calling, requiring you to look bland rather than formidable, yet never, since you had a beard, threw yourself into a martial attitude, and frowned before the looking glass. It is doubtful whether our soldiers would be maintained, if there were not pacific people at home who like to fancy themselves soldiers. War, like other dramatic spectacles, might possibly cease for want of a public. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.